You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 343, or 41st Q&A. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you doing?
Pretty good. Can't complain.
Yeah.
I'm trying not to segue into fantasy football, but it's a little hard. It's that time of year.
Yeah, don't stop yourself, because that's where I'm going too. I had a rough first start.
Well, I'm playing Tim this week. You know, I'm playing Tim in week two.
Well, how'd you do the first
shout week? Out to Tim anyway?
Yeah. Well, Tim's getting
first week I lost.
If I lose to Tim, I'm going to go back and cut out all these shout outs for Tim.
No, first week I lost. You know, I just left too many points on the bench. You know, I have the guys. I just didn't make good decisions. So, but first week it's like, you know, are they going to use this guy? How are they going to use him? So it's just always sort of a, I don't know what to do, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I'm 0-1.
Yeah, me too, Mike. Me too. How's the rain there? Y'all getting hit by some of these hurricanes?
You know, it rained hard yesterday for about 20, 30 minutes, which is a little longer than usual. But like my brother asked, are you guys getting the tropical storm? And I didn't even know we had one, you know, like, well, maybe that was it, you know, 20, 30 minutes of whatever, but it hasn't rained since. So, you know, if that's all it is, then it feels kind of normal, maybe just 10 minutes longer than usual, but.
Yeah. All right, Mike. Well, that's all I got. That's all the chitty chat I got for today. I'm all out.
Can't get too far ahead. We can't devote too much time to that.
Yeah.
To fantasy. Right. So,
well, Mike, they'll just fast forward. So that's okay. They probably fast forward through the first parts of our podcast
anyway.
Already
done
so,
that.
Yeah. So they probably don't even know I'm on the show. So that's fine. All right, like, who's this guy asking questions? But all right. All right. Well, we've got some great questions this episode, and let's start off with Tim. He's got a question regarding the Mary and Tiberius Pantera myth, where it's rumored that Mary really was either raped or had an affair with this Roman soldier. Since a tomb was found semi-recently with the soldier's name on it in Germany, and James Tabor wrote a whole book on it, there have been a lot of amateur people trying to use it along with its references in the Talmud and Origins writing to disprove Christ's divinity and henceforth steer people away from Christianity. However, I've only found two scholars' works on it, James Tabor and Ben Witherington. James Tabor claims Jesus was referred to as Jesus' son of Pantera during his life. It seems hogwash to me, but I have no defense against it. Were the Jews expecting a virgin birth as we understand a virgin today? Does Mary's virginity matter in reference to Christ's divinity?
Yeah, let's back up and go through the elements of the question, you know, as I recall them. I mean, there's very little written on this which ought to tell you something. You know, there you know, maybe with the exception of Tabor, you know, who's probably the only scholar, I don't know if I want to say in the world, but that might not be an exaggeration. That might be the only biblical scholar that was positively predisposed to the Talpiot tomb being the tomb of Jesus and his family, you know, I don't know, 10 years ago, whatever that was, 10, 15 years ago, with Simcha Jakubowicz, you know, that was popularized. It's almost Da Vinci Code level stuff. But other than him, other than that one guy, basically, this is a yawner for everybody else in New Testament scholarship. That's, you know, that really isn't much of an exaggeration. You know, the interesting thing about Tabor's work is his book is not a scholarly book. It's written for a popular audience, which leaves it vulnerable on one hand to critics. Now, I'm going to refer our listeners to a specific article here. Again, there's not much written on this, but what is written on this idea, and specifically Tabor's work, is not very favorable to Tabor. Let's just put it that way. And so it, since that book, The Jesus Dynasty, was not written for academics, Taber leaves a lot of things out. He takes a lot of things for granted. You know, he presumes a certain amount of knowledge and, more importantly, a good amount of ignorance on the part of his readers that he isn't going to get away with when it comes to New Testament scholars. And that's why there's been, you know, A, little interest in the topic, and B, you know, those who have interacted with Taber, you know, it's not very favorable at all. And I'm trying to be nice about it. You know, you mentioning the Talmud and Origins writings. Jewish sources pick up on this idea, I think, for pretty obvious reasons. They want to use the idea as propaganda against Jesus. I mean, they also, you know, the Talmud also calls Jesus a magician, you know, to explain away the miracles and things like that. So they're going to, you know, Jewish sources are going to use whatever they can to, you know, try to undermine, you know, this rival, okay, to their own status and their own, you know, particular belief system. So that isn't surprising. I mean, Origen's writings, Origen isn't quoting this or mentioning it with approval or like, oh, there's really something here. I mean, far from it. So it's a little, you know, I wanted to sort that out a little bit just in terms of what's in the question. Let's not get the impression that, you know, this thing had lots of ancient support. It didn't. It had support where you would expect to find it. Again, in people who were opponents of Jesus, they're naturally going to say stuff like this. And, you know, newsflash, the New Testament, you know, has the Pharisees claiming that Jesus was, you know, born of, you know, fornication. You know, they don't call it rape, but, you know, it's, you know, some other thing happens to Mary. I mean, that's their default, you know, sort of way to tar and feather or tarnish the reputation of Jesus within the gospel. So, you know, that idea generally is not new at all. And again, it comes from where you'd expect it to come. So for those who are interested in this, I would say I'm going to put this in the protected folder. But there's an article, again, there's very little on this that's accessible. But there's an article by Christopher B. Zeichman, and the title is Jesus Ben Pantera, you know, Son of Pantera, an epigraphic, refers to inscriptions, an epigraphic and military historical note. The source is the Journal for the Study of the Historical Jesus. It's volume 18, number 2. It's a 2020 publication, so it's pretty recent. Again, there just isn't a whole lot on this. And you know, one other note, the fact that there is an inscription that identifies a soldier with the name Pantera that gets associated with this myth, that doesn't mean that that's the guy. I mean, there's a lot of reasons to he's not identified in any other way. Okay, well, we have the same name. Well, like how many, you know, how many soldiers do we think might have shared this name or whatever, you know? But if you read the article, you'll find out that there are a number of significant disconnects between things that Taber is claiming, you know, basically conclusions he tries to reach based upon very scant, you know, data. There are a lot of disconnections between that and, again, what he wants to do with them. You know, they're sort of the reality of the situation, the reality of the data. So if you're interested in that, I recommend it. You know, the other question is really, you know, about the expectation of a virgin birth. So the question was worded, were the Jews expecting a virgin birth as we understand, you know, virgin today, and does it matter? I think expecting is probably too strong a word for Jewish, you know, outlook on the Messiah, for the simple reason that a lot of the messianic profile was not clear anyway by design. Again, my view, and it's not terribly shocking if you actually look at the Old Testament and then the ignorance of the disciples, even after the resurrection, they still don't quite know what's going on. And the reason for that is not because they were stupid. The reason for that is that the messianic profile is never given in one place in the Old Testament. It's fragmented and scattered in pieces all over the Old Testament. And so there's no reason to suspect that this particular point of how things play out would have been transparent so that the majority of the Jewish community was, quote unquote, expecting it. That's why I say I think that word's a bit, you know, too strong. You know, so on the one hand, you know, if you go back to Isaiah 7:14, and again, I'm hoping this isn't news to, you know, this audience anyway. But if you go back to Isaiah 7:14, you know, behold, you know, most translations will have behold a virgin shall conceive and so on and so forth. If you actually go back to the context of Isaiah 7, I'm going to read it because it's kind of important. And again, this, I think the way Christians are insufficiently taught to read their Old Testament gets used against them on this point. So if you go to Isaiah 7, it's the chapter starts this way. In the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, king of Judah, in his day, Rezin, the king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, the king of Israel, that's the northern kingdom. So you got the king of the north, and then you got this other king from Syria. Those two dudes came up to Jerusalem to wage war against it, but could not yet mount an attack against it. When the house of David was told, isn't that? And that's an interesting phrase to hold on, the house of David. You know, Isaiah, the writer, wants us to specifically to have the Davidic dynasty in mind here. When the house of David was told, hey, Syria is in league with Ephraim, the heart of Ahaz and the heart of his people shook as the trees of the forest shake before the wind. So the king of Judah, David's heir, is scared. And then he goes and he summons Isaiah, and they get into this conversation about this trouble and what's going to happen to us and so on and so forth. And in verse 10, we read this. The Lord spoke to Ahaz, ask a sign of the Lord your God. I mean, so God is like speaking to the king now, right? Maybe it's through the prophet, but maybe it's like something more direct. Ask a sign of the Lord your God. Let it be deep as Sheol or high as heaven. I mean, God pretty much opens the door for it. You know, and he wants the king to ask for a sign to validate, you know, what has been said in the conversation at this point. You know, God is basically saying, look, don't worry about these two guys. I'll take care of it. But Ahaz said, I will not ask, and I will not put the Lord to the test. And he's trying to sound pious. And he said, hear then, O house of David, is it too little for you to weary men that you weary my God also? Therefore, the Lord himself, this is obviously the voice of the prophet now, the Lord himself will give you a sign. Okay, if you don't want to, you know, God asked you for a sign, you don't want to ask him for something, you're pretending to be too pious to presume upon God, you know, God gave you the chance, well, the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, the virgin shall conceive, and of course the Hebrew word there is Alma, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel. Now, everybody stops there, which is part of the problem. Continuing, verse 15, he shall eat curds and honey when he knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good. For before the boy knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good, in other words, before the boy is old enough, again, to eat the curds and the honey in the preceding line, before he's old enough for that, the land whose two kings you dread will be deserted. The Lord will bring upon you and upon your people and upon your father's house such days as have not come since the day that Ephraim departed from Judah, the king of Assyria. You know, and then he goes on about what's going to happen and so on and so forth. So the point of the Isaiah 7:14 prophecy, if you keep reading it and you go into chapter 8 especially, you realize that the prophesied child that was supposed to be born of the Alma, again, ESV translates that as virgin, that's a kid that lived in Isaiah's day. Okay, it has nothing to do directly with Jesus or a Messiah. I mean, the prophecy itself is for the king, Ahaz, and his people, you know, and the Davidic line and everybody else going, you know, the Lord's saying, look, I'll give you a sign. The Alma will have a child, and before that kid's old enough to eat solid food, your problem's going to get taken care of. Don't worry about it. So on the one hand, you know, we have to sort of keep this thing in context. If you were a Jew, it would be very normal for you to think of Isaiah 7:14 and think this thought. Oh, yeah, that already happened. You know, God already gave, you know, this child, and boy, we're thankful that he did, because the Davidic dynasty wasn't destroyed, it wasn't cut off, so on and so forth. So that would, like, if you just walked into a conversation with a first century Jew and you brought up Isaiah 7:14, they're not going to be thinking about Jesus. I mean, no, or the Messiah just generally. They're going to be thinking this is history. So the real question that we need to ask here is, well, there are several questions that we need to ask, because Matthew does use this verse as an analogy for what, you know, happens in the circumstances of Jesus' birth. So on one hand, it's easy to see how the Jews, again, that's kind of an odd term too, like all the Jews had the same thoughts, which is ridiculous. Of course, they're like today, there's not one body called the Jews, just like there isn't the Christians. But anyway, it's easy to see how the Jews didn't look at Isaiah 7:14 and think, you know, sexual virgin or Messiah, because of the way things play out in the book of Isaiah itself. Now, if you keep reading, you know, in Isaiah, the question is, well, who's the woman? Because the kid, you know, is born, you know, for Isaiah's day. And so, you know, scholars disagree based on certain things that Isaiah says in the next chapter. Is it the prophet's wife? You know, some people argue for that. Is it the king's wife? Which adds a bit of mystery, like well, how would Isaiah know that she either is pregnant or would get pregnant? You know what I mean? Is the term Alma drawn or an allusion to an Ugaritic term for the queen, you know, for the king's wife, you know, and then that, you know, takes on a different flavor. I mean, there are a number of discussions here. None of them directly pertain, you know, to why Matthew would use this as an analogy. The real questions are whether sexual virgin, I'm just going to give you a short list. Is sexual virgin, is that a possible interpretation for the term in Isaiah 7:14, Alma? Another question, is Matthew's thought that Isaiah 7:14 served as an analogy for Jesus' birth and that a divine parentage was compatible with the messianic idea of the Old Testament? Is that valid? In other words, you know, can you look at the Old Testament and think or come away with the conclusion possibly that the Messiah would be the Son of God, like there's divine parentage there, you know, as well as the whole virginal, you know, question. And that, again, this would have something to do with the Davidic promise and all this stuff. I mean, can you look at these Old Testament passages and draw these conclusions? In other words, are those interpretations possible, you know, for what you do get in the Old Testament, even before, you know, Jesus comes along, where you can sort of look in hindsight and see what happens? So I want to take those apart a little bit first, you know, and try to do this, you know, in as briefly as I can. Sexual virgin is a possible meaning for Alma in Isaiah 7:14. Any Jew who knew their Old Testament would have known this. And so when they're reading Isaiah 7, since the woman, identity of the woman is not clear, okay, maybe the king's, you know, if she's the king's wife, you know, probably not a virgin because they're married, okay? But if it's some other woman, you know, could we have a sexual virgin in view? And the reason why this is valid, this is a possibility, is because of the way the term is used elsewhere. Now, you're going to get, you know, again, village atheists on the internet and people, again, who just, you know, let's use a published figure, you know, someone that's gotten a lot of play. I mean, I don't even know if he's still alive anymore, but Bishop Spong, you know, he was the guy who popularized this thing about Alma is not a sexual virgin. And, you know, I guess he was a Catholic. I don't know what he was, but, you know, he's basically undermining his own doctrine. And, oh, well, he's a church guy, so that he must know what he's talking about. Actually, he didn't know squat. He doesn't know what he's talking about. All he needs to do is read Genesis 24. Okay, if you go to Genesis 24, you know, again, how hard could this be? I'm just going to go to Genesis 24. This is the Isaac and Rebekah story. So, you know, Abraham, you know, sends out his servant Eliezer, you know, go find a wife, you know, for Isaac and so on and so forth. And, you know, we know the story about how the, you know, Eliezer encounters Rebekah at the well and so on and so forth. So I'm just going to jump into verse 15. So Eliezer has just prayed, you know, Lord, you know, direct me, give me this or that sign that the woman, you know, who my master should marry. And we read this: before he had finished speaking, behold, Rebekah, who was born to Bethuel, the son of Milcah, the wife of Nahor, Abraham's brother, came out with her water jar on her shoulder. The young woman, that's the Hebrew Na'ara, which is just a generic description of a young girl, was very attractive in appearance. A maiden, the term there is Betulah, whom no man had known, again, sexually, Betulah is the more technical term for sexual virgin. And so Spong would say, look, you know, if Isaiah 7:14 meant a virgin, they would have used Betulah. That's the only term that means sexual virgin for women in the old in Hebrew. Actually, it isn't. And that's what I'm going to show you here in a moment. It isn't. But anyway, we have here Rebecca is very clearly a Betulah, a maiden whom no man had known. And again, those of you who are familiar with biblical euphemisms know that to know a woman means to, you know, have sexual relations with her. You know, any number of passages that use this idiom. So it's very clear Rebecca in Genesis 24 is a sexual virgin. Well, if you keep reading Genesis 24 about the Rebecca story, this is what you run into. So Eliezer, you know, has now like let the cat out of the bag. Like, you know, I'm here looking for a wife, you know, for my servant or my master Abraham, his son. And, you know, I think the Lord's directing me to you. And, you know, he's basically telling her that he thinks God is picking her for, you know, to be a wife to Isaac, who of course she's never met. And he says in verse 42, I came today to the spring and said, O Lord, the God of my master Abraham, if now you are prospering the way that I go, behold, I'm standing by the spring of water. Let the virgin who comes out to draw water, to whom I shall say, please give me a little water from your jar to drink. You know, let her be the one. Well, guess what? The word translated virgin there in ESV is Alma. It's the same word as in Isaiah 7:14. And we already know from, you know, 10, 15, whatever it is, verses earlier, that Rebecca is a sexual virgin. Well, here the writer uses Alma of a woman who is, in fact, point blank, a sexual virgin. So this tells you that Alma in Isaiah 7:14 could indeed be an appropriate word that could be used of a woman who is a sexual virgin. So, you know, Bishop Spong and the rest of his ilk, you know, basically didn't spend much time reading their Old Testament. So that we can take off the table. Yes, that is a possossible interpretation for Isaiah 7:14. The other two questions. Okay, what about the link to a dynastic idea? Isaiah 7:14 is certainly linked to the Davidic dynasty because it's about Ahaz and the house of David. So by saving, you know, by giving the king a sign about this woman, God was saying, look, I am going to honor my promise to preserve David's line, okay, which will in turn, of course, produce the Messiah, the new son of David. And so Isaiah 7:14 is indeed connected to the messianic promise by virtue of David's dynastic house, okay? Thirdly, what about a divine child, you know, down the road? I think the answer, yes, this is on the table because I'll approach it this way. You know, first of all, a virgin birth is kind of a common idea in ancient religions for divine parentage for what ought to be obvious reasons. So if you thought that, you know, either, you know, after the fact that, oh, you know, that This kid is unusual. You know, he probably, you know, has, you know, divine parentage because of this, that, or the other thing, you know, some weird power or something like that. Again, that was very common. If you were thinking about some prophecy in your religion, okay, that called for, here's the key thought. There's a prophecy that called for somebody who was more than a human mortal. You could very easily presume that the source for that kid, the fulfillment of that promise, would indeed be born, you know, from of the Most High. And then you get your virgin birth idea. So I would suggest that this is on the table for a few reasons. A Jew who thought carefully about the covenants with Israel would realize that they were impossible for any normal human to fulfill. They're just impossible. Because a human is always going to fail, and they always did in the whole Old Testament story. So for this reason, I think Christ's deity certainly matters. He is the fulfillment of all the covenants. And I don't know how you get deity incarnate without the virgin birth. So again, the result of a normal birth would be a normal human. So these things, you know, seem to go together, I think, pretty transparently. Another thought is things said of the Messiah in certain passages of the Old Testament do speak of more than human status. You know, how can a merely human Davidic Messiah be the referent of Psalm 89:29? It says, this is, again, the theme is the Davidic covenant, you know, but it's in a psalm. I will establish his offspring forever and his throne as the days of the heavens. You know, that requires a little bit more than a mere, you know, mortal. Okay. So we have that issue. A mere mortal doesn't fit that. How about Daniel 7? Okay, the Son of Man, the eschatological Son of Man, especially if Daniel 7, and it is, and I've lectured on this before, people can find it on YouTube, is linked to the Baal cycle, the kingship of the gods. And in this case, the kingship is handed to the, quote, human one. That requires somebody that's more than a mere mortal. Again, I don't know how you're going to get that unless you have, you know, deity incarnate. And I don't know how you're going to get deity incarnate without a virgin birth. And again, these ideas are connected. And I'll throw one more thought in here. We cannot assume that early Judaism, forget Christianity, but we're talking about early Judaism before Christianity. You can't assume that early Judaism did not include the idea of a divine Messiah. I mean, a lot of these people write as though, you know, Christians were the first ones to come up with this. Wrong. First Enoch, for instance, certainly does. It speaks of the Messiah's pre-existence, okay, before they're born in several places. So did the writer of Enoch not know his Hebrew Bible? I would suggest that he did. Let me give you an example. So let me read a little bit from my the second volume of my Enoch commentary. I just turned in the manuscript, but this is my little header for 1 Enoch 45-57. This section opens with the plight of the wicked, those who have, quote, denied the Lord of Spirits. They are juxtaposed with the elect one, the chosen one, the Messiah figure, who is seated to judge them. From this point forward, the Messiah, a figure described by various titles, and in the book I have a whole excursus on that, takes the place of prominence in the Book of the Parables, which is this section of the Book of Enoch. He is described as pre-existent, the seated judge, the eschatological ruling Son of Man, the anointed one. There's your word, Mashiach. And then I quote Susan Doherty on this, you know, this point. But here's a little bit from 1 Enoch 48. I'm just going to read you the first six verses, okay? And in that place, I saw the fountain of righteousness, which was inexhaustible. And around it were many fountains of wisdom, and all the thirsty drank of them, and they were filled with wisdom. And their dwellings were with the righteous and the holy and elect. And at that hour, that Son of Man was named in the presence of the Lord of the Spirits, and his name before the head of days. Okay, that's the Ancient of Days from Daniel 7. So there's this scene where the Son of Man, okay, who hasn't yet been incarnate yet. I mean, this is the heavenly Son of Man, was named, you know, to fulfill this role. Yea, before the sun and the signs were created, before the stars of the heavens were made, his name was named before the Lord of Spirits. He shall be a staff to the righteous whereon to stay themselves and not fall, and he shall be the light of the Gentiles, and the hope of those who are troubled of heart. All who dwell on earth shall fall down and worship before him, and will praise and bless and celebrate with song the Lord of Spirits. For this reason he has been chosen and hidden before him, before the creation of the world and forevermore. Okay, that is pre-Christian First Enoch. So, again, if you have, again, the village internet atheist, you know, who wants to argue these points like this is a Christian invention, I'm sorry, but you might want to go back and read primary texts. That might be a good idea. What this shows you is that Jews, again, you know, we'll use the generic Jew term, Jews, before there was a Jesus, were looking at passages like Daniel 7 and passages concerning the, quote, anointed one, the Mashiach, the Messiah, and interpreting them to lead them to the conclusion that that guy, whoever that is, has to be more than man because he's pre-existent and other things. So again, I don't know how you get that if you don't have, you know, if you're not the Son of God, if you don't have divine parentage, which would, again, indeed be quite consistent with a virgin birth. Now that was a long way to answer those questions, but the questions are actually filled with misconceptions, not on the questioner's part, but on the thing that's troubling, the person who asked the question, Tim in this case. Because you will often see this discussed on the internet by people who have no command of the data. Okay, that's just the way it is. So I wanted to throw a lot of that in and go off on these rabbit trails because I think they're important.
Tracy has her next two questions, and the first one is, what do you mean by the term evangelical? This is a term that many people feel they know, but I am not convinced that it actually means the same thing to everyone. Would you please elaborate as to what it means to you?
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that. You know, this is, I agree on its ambiguity. And today, honestly, its relative meaninglessness. I have what used to be the tried and true definition of maybe 30 years ago, stuck in my head. So I'm old enough to remember when you could use the term evangelical and it did mean something. And so what to me it means is that you have someone who A, understands the biblical gospel message of salvation by grace through faith apart from human merit. And B, that person, a person who believes that message, the message of the gospel, is the only means of salvation. Circa John 14:6, Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father except through me. And they also believe that all, believers have been commanded to spread that message. In other words, an evangelical is someone who believes in the Great Commission. They also would be a person that approves the historic orthodoxy of the Apostolic Church, the content of things like in the Apostles' Creed, the Nicene Creed, the core doctrines of Christianity. And then lastly, an evangelical would be someone who believes the Bible is the inspired Word of God, not contains the Word of God, but is the Word of God. Now, evangelicals have historically disagreed on, how to articulate the idea of inspiration. Certainly, how to articulate inerrancy, is that a useful term? What it's associated with the term inspiration. I'm not worried about any of that for the sake of this answer. That's what an evangelical is, just in a nutshell. Again, it used to be where you didn't have to walk through that, but today you do. So I understand, what's behind the question.
Tracy's second question is, regarding the line of the Lord's Prayer translated generally as forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us, or forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. My question is about the as. I have generally taken it to mean in the same manner as, but I've also come to realize that it could also mean at the same time as. Does the Greek provide any insight into which was intended? Both certainly would seem to be appropriate, such a little word to mean so much.
Yeah, I mean, the Greek is as, okay, the word is hos. So the term is what it is in terms of what it is. Now, the issue is, of course, semantics. And, this is, for those of you who've had a little Greek, if you wanted to look up something like, Wallace's Greek Grammar Beyond the Basics, which is a book on Greek syntax, exegetical syntax of the New Testament. This is going to be in the chapter on conjunctions, specifically adverbial conjunctions. So if you wanted to look it up, you could. But Wallace discusses hos in terms of its semantics. What are its possible meaning? What's the range of meanings here? It's very common to take this as causal. You would translate it because of or something like that. Manner is very common in that, Tracy sort of sketched that out, the same manner as. You could also interpret hos as indicating the result of something that's preceded. And then, if you just keep going through Wallace, you're going to hit temporal. And this pertains to Tracy's question about could the particle mean at the same time or something like that. And if you were looking at this, I would say maybe a good source for this, that those who have Greek are going to know what this is. But if you go to BDAG, which is the standard Greek lexicon for New Testament Greek, they will include a discussion of the temporal semantic in relation to this particle. Okay, and so they'll say this in the little section of their entry, temporal conjunction. And then they give page numbers to BDF, which is Blass, De Brunner, and Funk, another Greek reference grammar. When this particle is followed by the aorist tense verb, then if you think it's temporal, you would translate it something like when or after. Okay? If it is paired with a present verb, like if it's followed by a present form of a verb, then you would choose to translate it something like while or when. Okay, to create this sort of contemporaneous time, you know, sort of situation. So if we were going to go, let's just go to the Lord's Prayer here and, you know, take a look at this as what the options are. I'm in Matthew 6 now. So our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread and forgive us our debts as we also have forgiven our debtors. Okay, so this is the line right here. So as is hos, or the particle we're talking about, and it's followed by, what's the verb form here? The text that the ESV is using is aorist. So you could translate that on the basis of this as, forgive us our debts when we also forgive our debtors. So what it does is it sort of requires you to forgive, you know, people before, you know, God's going to forgive you your debts, you know, that sort of thing, that there's a symbiotic relationship here. If it was a present verb form, you know, forgive us our debts while we, or when we, you know, have forgiven our debtors. So it makes it a little bit more contemporaneous. Now, honestly, I think it's a bit of a distinction without a difference, because the whole point of the passage is that God wants you to forgive people, you know, and because he's willing to forgive you, you need to be willing to forgive, you know, people. So I a little excerpt here to wrap up, you know, the question. This is from R.T. France, which is my favorite Matthew commentary, or Gospel of Matthew. It's in the NIC series. He writes this. He actually discusses the semantics of this particle a little bit. And by the way, you know, when you hear me read this, these are the kinds of commentaries, even if you haven't had Greek or Hebrew, if you just know the alphabet and you have a resource like, you know, Logos Bible software, where you can look up grammatical terms, or you have books like Wallace's Greek Grammar, his exegetical syntax, that you can search with software, you'd be able to understand the discussion. Take a little work if you didn't have a year of Greek, but you could do it. So France writes, again, the good commentaries are the ones that engage the text. If you have a commentary that doesn't engage the text, then what good is it really? So he says this, the hos, as, again, this particle, which links the two halves of this clause, leaves open the question whether the forgiveness of our fellow humans is to be understood strictly as a prior condition of our being forgiven. The variation in the manuscripts, this is really interesting, as to the tense of the verb, now that tells you already that Greek manuscripts of Matthew 6:12, some of them have aorist forms and some of them have present tense forms. They're not all the same. The variation in the manuscripts as to the tense of the verb perhaps reflects uncertainty on this issue. The aorist tense properly indicating that our forgiveness of others is prior to God's requested forgiveness of us, while the present may be thought to allow a less precise relationship. But perhaps precision on this point is not necessary. And here I'm with him. I mean, I love, you know, Francis' commentary and other stuff he writes, because he just thinks well, you know, in so many respects. I mean, he'll take you down these roads and talk with you. He says, perhaps precision on this point is not necessary. The issue is whether the forgiveness sought from God is mirrored in the attitude of those who pray. In the parable of Matthew 18:23-35, God's forgiveness comes first, but it's withdrawn when the person forgiven fails to forgive another, actually just rebels. If you go back and read the parable, he has no interest in forgiving the other guy. There is then, France says, something inevitably reciprocal about forgiveness. To ask to be forgiven while oneself refusing to forgive is hypocritical. Those who ask for forgiveness must be forgiving people, whether the offenses concerned are past or future. And I think that's why I say the semantic to me here, the discussion, you know, is it manner in the same way, Well, of course it is. You're supposed to forgive your people who've offended you in the same way that God, you know, forgives you. Temporal, you know, whether it's, well, you know, God really wants me to forgive them first, you know, and then he'll know where my heart's at, you know, and I won't be a hypocrite. Or is it something a little more closely contemporaneous or simultaneous? Hey, at the end of the day, what God wants is you to forgive people. Okay, and he'll forgive you. You know, if you don't do that, like France says, you're a hypocrite. Now, when it comes to the salvation question, okay, you know, that's a different question. We're not talking about accepting the gospel here. We're talking about asking God to forgive us when we do sin. And he's really speaking, you know, Matthew's speaking to people who believe. I mean, he's not speaking to unbelievers, you know, in the Lord's Prayer. It's the Lord's Prayer. Okay. He's speaking to people who believe. And if you don't want your relationship with the Lord disrupted, you know, by the sins that you commit, that you need to own up to as a child of God, well then, you know, you need to do the same. Otherwise you're a hypocrite. You know, and God knows, and he's not pleased, you know, with that. He wants the same heart response out of you that he is, you know, going to show toward you. So it's a good question. You know, it really, I like this question because it takes you sort of into the granular level of the text. You know, once you perceive a problem, or not a problem, that's the wrong word. Once you perceive sort of an interpretive issue, you know, like should I go this way? Should I think this or that or the other way? You know, this is you know, good stuff because it makes you think about what you're reading as opposed to your eyes just sort of, you know, flying right over the text. So that was a good question, but I think at the end of the day, it's kind of a distinction without a difference.
All right, Mike, that's all the questions we have this week. Do you have any idea what topic we're going to be covering for the next week?
Oh, I don't. I haven't even looked ahead. I mean, I've got three or four sort of queued up, but I haven't landed anywhere.
All right. Sounds good. Well, don't forget, you can send me your questions at treystrickland@gmail.com. And with that, Mike, I want to thank everybody for sending in those questions and for you answering them. And I want to thank everybody else for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.